Good afternoon, and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, North Coast Director of Friends of the Eel River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Citizens of California's North Coast are often quite familiar with a broad range of natural resource issues, particularly around forestry and fisheries, that are both part of our lives and our neighbors' lives, and a regular subject of press coverage and everyday conversation. Similarly, we know a fair amount about the public agencies, both state and federal, that manage these resources, and even about the nonprofits, which play key roles on so many subjects. But there's often another kind of player in the mix on many of these issues, the independent scientific consultancy. The North Coast is now home to a number of these businesses, and they play an increasingly central role in many of the critical natural resource questions that continue to frame life on the North Coast. Today, we'll be speaking with Dennis Halligan, a senior fisheries biologist with Stillwater Sciences, about some of the work he and Stillwater have been doing both in this region and beyond, trying to get at both what the vital issues are and at the role of the independent scientific consultant in addressing them. Dennis, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Scott.
Great to have you. Why don't we start by having you sketch your own biography? You've got a long personal history with fisheries on the North Coast.
Well, I was born and raised in Northern California, so I've had natural resources in my backyard all my life. I came to Humboldt State in 1976 and went through the fisheries program, graduated in 1980. During that period of time, I was working up in Alaska, fishing and working in canneries to put myself through school. And following graduation, I started fishing commercially. And during that period of time, I also started an oyster mariculture business in Humboldt Bay. And around 1992, I ended up turning around and leaving all that production end of things and volunteered to the Forest Service, started into freshwater fisheries. And from there, that was, 20 years ago. So here I am now.
So what's similar and what's different about the role you play at Stillwater as a scientific consultant as opposed to, you know, the role you played when you were working for an agency or working as a fish catcher or fish or oyster maker?
One of the similarities between all those occupations is you get to work in the great outdoors, as it were, and see some land and waters that not very many people get a chance to see. And so it's really something that helps recharge batteries, and really you get a much deeper connection, I think, to the land and the environment. From the commercial fisheries and oyster farming, it tends to be more production-oriented. And so you're subject to rules and regulations, and you're concerned about habitat and water quality and issues like that. From the consultancy side of things, well, number one, you get a lot more seat time, you know, and a lot more writing goes on, and the amount of time you spend out in the natural world tends to get reduced the longer you're in the business, and your experience, you know, grows through a whole bunch of different projects. But I think you still maintain that deep connection with the land, and you want to see the right thing done.
So let's talk just a bit about Stillwater Sciences, the company. What's the company's history, and what does Stillwater focus on?
Well, the company was founded in 1996, is basically by four or five individuals who left a larger engineering firm. And the home office is down in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And during that founding, and actually prior to it, those individuals had a real close connection with UC Berkeley professors and academics and had a lot of academic involvement in a number of projects. In about 10 years ago, they founded the Arcata office. And we currently have about 10 or 12 of us in the office right now, and then Davis office. And we also have smaller offices in Portland and Santa Cruz and Santa Barbara. And basically what we try to do is try to combine the physical and biological sciences, geomorphology and sediment transport and things like that, with like fisheries and wildlife, and to come up with the linkages between the physical and biological parameters that these organisms depend upon. And so that is basically in a big picture what we do. And just like back in the founding days, we tend to collaborate quite a bit with academics for both their expertise that they can bring, specialties, as well as peer reviewing documents that we may be producing. And so our whole idea is we try to bring the best science to bear on every project that we are engaged for. Quite frankly, that has worked really well. And we work for a whole host of different clients. We'll work for the federal agencies, state, private landowners. We work for nonprofits, both environmental organizations and general nonprofits like Redwood Community Action Agency.
Sure.
So we span the gamut.
This is the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson, North Coast Director for Friends of the Eel River, and I'm talking today with Dennis Halligan, Senior Fisheries Biologist with Stillwater Sciences. Dennis, looking at the Stillwater website, it's obvious the company's part of a lot of projects all over California and the West Coast, as you mentioned. We could talk about just a couple of examples that reflect the spread, if you will, of the kind of work Stillwater does.
One big example that everyone up here is familiar with is the whole Klamath Dam removal. We've been involved in that for quite a few years now, beginning with sediment transport modeling. What happens if you remove the dams and all the sediment behind it gets released? Where does it go? How much of it gets flushed out? Where does it settle? What's the impact on the aquatic and estuarine biota? And so we've worked on that. We've been doing quite a bit of work down in the Sacramento-San Joaquin system.
Really?
Yeah. We do a bunch of levee setback work, in-stream flow analyses. We have been heavily involved since basically 2002, involved in the San Joaquin River Restoration Program, bringing the stakeholders together and coming up with a restoration plan, as well as doing the aquatics and water quality sections of the programmatic EIR for that. Some of the smaller jobs we tend to do, and we do flood control projects, such as down in the Napa River. One I was involved in for several years is the St. Helena Comprehensive Flood Control Program, which, quite frankly, from a fisheries biologist standpoint, was manna from heaven because we were able to rip out 17 houses and 16 acres of vineyards and 800 feet of gabion wall and create a natural stream bank habitat and low elevation floodplain for flood detention and all this native riparian planting and stuff like that.
And actually create some fish habitat.
And California freshwater shrimp habitat.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, it was a very fun project. Now we're doing 5 years worth of monitoring on that.
Are there ways in which it's better for the public and for your customers to have an independent group like Stillwater involved in a project, as opposed to having the agencies or other organizations develop their own internal scientific and technical expertise? Can you talk about the trade-offs there?
I think it's good to have both. And the reason being is there will be some, let's say, smaller project proponents, applicants, you name it. And they do not have the expertise in-house. Let's say you're some rancher locally and you want to put a bridge in over a creek to replace a culvert.
Right.
Okay. There may be permitting issues. There may be issues relating to dewatering the stream and removing salmon and steelhead that may be there and relocating them, stuff like that. That landowner doesn't have that capability. So that's when that person would end up coming to a consultant, hire them. Hey, you have the expertise. You have the equipment. You've done it before. You're much more efficient. Bingo. Why don't you do this for me? Okay, great. Now, if you're like an agency, say you're a National Marine Fisheries Service, just for kicks.
Right.
You deal with these issues every single day. It behooves you to develop the expertise because you're in it for the long haul and the long term. So from that respect, it's cheaper than going out for every little dinky project and hiring a consultant. However, there still are instances where they may not have the specialty in-house, say sediment transport modeling or something like that, where they actually do need to go out and contract out. And so then they'd come to a consultant or they'll fly a request for proposals and then hire somebody. I think for some organizations, say private timber companies, Green Diamond, Humboldt Redwood Company, they have habitat conservation plans where they have to do continuous long-term monitoring.
Right.
For them, it's beneficial and cheaper for them to develop the in-house expertise to collect those data. And all those reports have agency oversight and review and stuff like that. And then they, similar to agencies, they will end up hiring outside consultants for specialty work. And then there's other outfits, say public utilities, that have biologists that are hired to oversee biological programs or permitting. And then they will go out and actually hire a consultant to do the NEPA, CEQA documentation, biological studies, that kind of thing for any given project. Say it be a power line reconductoring that may go across urban and forest and wetland areas, or just some kind of pipeline removal from Humboldt Bay.
Sure. So I want to take advantage of having you in the studio, Dennis, to talk about one of the perennial hot issues on the North Coast, the status of our fisheries. And maybe it's a little too early still to give a definitive assessment of 2011's returns, but we could start with a quick and dirty review of how different salmonids, mostly Chinook and coho salmon and steelhead trout, are doing in various parts of the North Coast from your perspective as a longtime observer.
Right now, I'm pretty encouraged. There seem to be a lot of fish in the systems. Yeah. We have had pretty good rainfall the past 3 years running. We haven't had really high peak flows that would blow out reds, salmon nests,
right,
after they're built in the gravel. We've had really good ocean conditions. So it seems like a lot of things have come together. And in addition, there has been a huge improvement in land use practices,
mm-hmm,
and restoration activities, both in-stream, putting in wood and boulder structures, as well as stabilizing landslides and upgrading road systems and things like that to reduce sediment delivery. And so it seems like all these things are coming together, and right now we're starting to see the benefit. However, I think one thing we need to be careful about is two good run years do not a species recovery make.
Right.
So we may have a couple, two or three really good run years, then it may be followed by two or three relatively poor ones or something. And so you get this up and down, up and down, up and down if you look at a graph. But the hope is if you connect, run a line through all those points, they're going in the right direction. That's the hope. Right now, from what I have seen, and quite frankly, from what's happening on the Eel River, it appears we're having a really good year on the eel, especially in relation to Chinook salmon. It's a little too early for steelhead and too early for coho. But Chinook, both on the eel and the mad, based upon dives I've done on the mad and on the Klamath, seem to be doing really well right now.
So let's talk about that eel report, because that actually really captured my attention. And I think you delivered what I thought was one of the most compelling sets of observations in terms of the eel's run this year. Last year, 2010, for all the limits on the data we're able to collect, looks like it was probably the strongest run for Chinook in decades on the eel. And this year may be as good, maybe even better. But what did you see when you went diving in the eel?
A lot of fish. I'll tell you, I've been diving the eel in all the local rivers every year since 1996. And the past couple of years have been pretty astounding. And typically what ends up happening is a lot of fish before the rains show up get stacked up below Fernbridge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll dive through there and it'll be walls of fish and Moses parting the Red Sea as I swim through them.
And we're not talking about little teeny goldfish here. We're talking about fish the size of dogs, yeah.
Yeah, to put it in commercial fishermen's terms, we're talking about splitters. And you split the grade at about 15 pounds.
Uh-huh.
And so anything above 15 pounds is a splitter.
Uh-huh.
You're looking
right
at some pretty big fish and lots of them.
Yeah.
I'll just give you one story. I was diving the 12th Street hole, which is right near Riverwalk.
It's just below the River Lodge at Fortuna. Yeah.
Yes. And as I was swimming, I was going downstream because it's an awful long ways to swim upstream. Swimming on downstream, and I ran into a school of fish that was about 20 feet wide, 10 feet deep, and going for at least 100 feet long. And they were stacked in there, one on top of another. Just easily 1,000 fish in this school. And just like I say, Moses parting the Red Sea, I swim right through them, and they just open up an alley
right
for me to go right through. And it's just, those are good days in the field.
Indeed. So again, we do need to be careful about drawing conclusions from limited data. Let's just talk a little bit about what kind of data we need to draw clearer conclusions over the long run and how we could get those kind of data.
Well, I think basically you need to follow life histories. And one thing that everybody likes to see is how many big fish came back.
Right.
So that is one thing. So I think collecting some good long-term data using established protocols with good equipment every year will give you a pretty darn good idea of adult returns.
We should point out that on the eel, at least, there's really been one long-term monitoring station, and that's at the very top of the mainstem eel at the Van Arsdale Fish Counting Station attached to the Cape Horn Dam.
Yes, and that accounts for about 1% of the drainage area.
Right. And so you're just not getting a clear picture of the whole return and the state of the whole watershed.
Right. And so the hot tip would be to set up some kind of monitoring station further on downstream of the Van Dusen, since right. that is the first major tributary, and a lot of fish go up the Van Dusen. So set something up like that, such as a Didson, which is a dual imaging and detection sonar. You'd probably need two of them because I think they're limited to about 100 foot of detection range.
And these are really exciting devices. If you look online, Google the name Didson, you'll see a webpage that shows how these devices work. And they sort of show a black and white video picture of fish moving past them.
Yeah, and they work in extremely turbid water. And they have one or had one running up on the Smith River.
That's correct, yeah.
With pretty good results and data. And so I think setting something up like that in a relatively constricted location, such as at Riverwalk, where you can have good security from vandals and stuff like that, and where you have easy access for people to maintain the equipment and download the data and stuff like that, would be really handy. So that's one end of things. The other thing you'd like to know is, what is our watershed producing? How many little fish are coming on down from these great adult returns? And so there you'd probably want to set up, you know, at strategic locations, some downstream migrant traps, similar to what they have up there on the Klamath River.
Mm-hmm.
And they could be rotary screw traps. So you start developing a long-term picture as to annual smolt production. So I think once you combine those, you can figure out, okay, what your survival rates are and that kind of thing. So you get juvenile populations coming down, and then you start understanding what the adult escapement or population is coming back. And you can figure out from the returns and the downstream migrants what systems are your really productive systems.
And in the case of the 3,700 square miles of the Eel River watershed, whether it's part of the South Fork or part of the Van Dusen, as you're saying, or that stretch of the upper main stem around Hearst that's producing the fish these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Where are they? And once you have that, you find these biological hotspots, it may help landowners, number one, to prioritize any restoration activities or to think carefully about the kinds of land use management activities they're engaged in.
Well, I really appreciate your time and coming in today, Dennis. Any thoughts about sort of the big picture, where you see the future of fisheries restoration and the North Coast going?
I'm an eternal optimist, and I guess I had to be a commercial fisherman for all those years. And so I really feel good about at least the North Coast, where we have so much involvement by the public and so much interest and so politically active, people really care. I don't feel as optimistic once you go further south.
Mm-hmm.
But from here and up in through Washington, I'm pretty optimistic. People are pretty well focused in on what needs to be done to help recover our fisheries resources.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Since the 1970s, the Trinity River Restoration Program has been working to restore structure and function to that river, which was severely altered by the construction of Lewiston Dam and the diversion of most of the Trinity's flows to the Central Valley. Over the last year, some key stakeholders have raised serious concerns over the efficacy and appropriateness of some of the Trinity River Restoration Program's projects. Those concerns came to a head in a November 28th letter from the California Water Impact Network and Trinity River Guides Association, calling for a moratorium on future projects pending a careful evaluation of projects already completed. With me today to discuss the situation is Tom Stokely from CWIN. Hi, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So, Tom, you served as the natural resources planner for Trinity County for a couple of decades, and you're a pretty strong supporter of the Trinity River Restoration Program in that position.
Yes, I am. I worked for two decades to get the environmental documents completed so that Bruce Babbitt could make his record of decision in 2000, and then after that I worked for 8 more years on subsequent environmental documents, raising bridges, moving obstructions out of the floodplain, and I still am a very big supporter of restoration of the Trinity River. I just have concerns about the way they're doing it.
So fairly quickly, could you give us the background on what you think the restoration program is supposed to be doing in the Trinity and where it's coming up short?
Sure. The Trinity River, which was dammed as a result of an act of Congress in 1955, had a provision put in there that the Interior Secretary was authorized and directed to preserve and propagate the fish and wildlife resources of the Trinity River. As a result of years of paperwork and debates and federal legislation and administrative actions, Bruce Babbitt made the Trinity River Record of Decision on December 19, 2000, with the former chairman of the Hoopa Valley Tribe, Dwayne Sherman. The Record of Decision called for increasing flows down the river, as well as doing channel restoration or manipulation projects to essentially take the handcuffs off the river and let the higher flows reshape it and create the habitat. There were also provisions to add spawning gravel to the river, to do watershed restoration, to do an adaptive management program with a lot of monitoring. And what we're concerned about right now is the so-called mainstem restoration projects. The idea is to bulldoze the banks of the river, which are very steep and covered with vegetation, to make them less steep and with low-velocity habitat for juvenile fish. And I think the hypothesis was reasonable, and the idea was to do about 44 of these projects, to do half of them over a several-year period, which are now completed, and then the Record of Decision called to take a break for a few years to have an independent scientific review team look at those projects and see if they have performed as they were supposed to see if they're actually helping improve the fishery. And the problem is that a number of these projects completed to date have actually failed. In some cases, they've constructed side channels, which are like parallel channels to the main stem of the river. Several of those have filled in with sediment and no longer function. In other cases, the 80,000 tons of spawning gravel that they injected into the river have overwhelmed most of the major holding and rearing pools for adult fish in the river from Lewiston Dam to Douglas City. And as a result, the Trinity River Fishing Guides Association wrote a letter to the restoration program back in March, which they still have not received a response to. My organization, along with the late Byron Leidecker, also wrote a letter on March 21st. Requesting a similar moratorium, among other things. Byron's letter did receive a response from the Commissioner of Reclamation in July, but he never addressed that issue. So basically, we've gone nearly 9 months without any response from the program to public requests to follow the Record of Decision. And so what we're asking for them to do is simply to follow what they said they were going to do and take a break, evaluate these projects, see if there's a better way to do them to make sure that they don't fail. I think a big hypothesis that's probably was incorrect in the Record of Decision was that huge amounts of spawning gravel needed to be injected into the river near Lewiston Dam to make up for what the dam stopped from coming in. It turns out that all of the major tributaries along the Trinity River have been accumulating sediment or putting sediment and spawning gravel into the river corridor. And with the higher flows that we've gotten over the last few years, that gravel has been mobilized. And essentially, there's been enough water to move the gravel, but there hasn't been enough water to remove it from these pools. And I'm not sure what it's going to take to clean these pools out again, but you can imagine the local reaction in the Lewiston area when most of the major pools where people fish have been significantly filled in. And we also really wonder, has the program shifted the limiting factor for salmon and steelhead from juvenile habitat to adult habitat? We don't know the answer. We'd like to see that in an independent review. And basically, from what we understand through the grapevine, even though no one has officially responded to us, they plan on moving ahead with these projects, many of which have failed, without looking back and seeing what they've done wrong so that they can avoid those problems in the future. And we're talking about millions and millions of dollars. I don't know if this number is completely correct, but one figure quoted was that $36 million had been spent on these projects over the last decade or so. And that's quite a bit of money. And I think the public needs to hold the agencies accountable for how this money is spent and how they plan on spending more money in the future.
This is the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson with Friends of the Eel River. I'm talking with Tom Stokely from the California Water Impact Network. Tom, the Redding Record Searchlight had a story on this situation we've been discussing. That the headline had you denouncing restoration. That doesn't sound like it's really an accurate portrayal of your position. It sounds like both the Water Impact Network and the Guides Association want to see restoration, you just want to see effective restoration.
Yeah, that's correct. We want to make sure that the money that's being spent is actually doing good things for the fishery. With these main stem projects, we really question whether it's been a good thing and whether it's really the best place to put the money. Just a side note that the Record of Decision also called for a fine sediment reduction program from the various watersheds and tributaries that feed into the Trinity River below Lewiston Dam, including the South Fork of the Trinity. But the Bureau of Reclamation has unilaterally made a decision that they will not spend any money outside of the 40-mile corridor from Lewiston Dam to the North Fork. We don't see how they're going to possibly succeed in restoring all the fish species in the Trinity River, particularly coho and steelhead, which are largely tributary creatures. We just don't see how they're going to meet the fishery restoration goals for those runs if they don't deal with the watershed. So we think it's a great time to take a break on the main stem projects while they're evaluated and put that money instead into watershed restoration, which is definitely a good bang for the buck.
So, Tom, as you look back on this overall process, including the more than 30 years that the larger Trinity River Restoration Program has been running, do you see lessons that you might take from this experience that might be more broadly applied to fisheries restoration efforts across northwestern California?
Yeah, I think that anybody who's doing fishery restoration needs to really continue the dialogue with the affected public, the landowners, the fishermen, the water and the power customers, everybody, to make sure that what they're doing is right. What we've seen in the case of the Trinity is really history repeating itself. Back in 1993, we had a very similar situation with similar projects that got out of control. The Trinity River ran like chocolate milk for the month of August 1993. The late Byron Lydecker, founder of Friends of Trinity River, got stuck in the mud. He was very angry, and he ended up shutting down the main stem program until there had been a more complete environmental review and ultimately the Trinity River Record of Decision. So I think what I've seen happen is that all the people involved in the restoration program mean well. They want to do good things for the river, but they get this attitude that it's their program, that they're doing God's work, and essentially that nobody should challenge them and nobody knows as much as they do. And it's just not a good attitude. All of these programs, which are funded with government money, need to continue the dialogue with the stakeholders and the user groups. In this case, it really broke down. There have been communications between the program and the fishing guides, but it was all pretty much one way, with the restoration program telling the guides how it's going to be, what they ought to know, what they're going to do, but without really listening to what the guides had to say. So we really did this as a last resort. We're hoping that the Trinity program will come to its senses and comply with the Record of Decision. We want to see the program succeed. We don't want to see it get defunded, but they're putting us into a very adversarial situation, which is really unfortunate. I think the Reading Record Searchlight editorial hit it right on, which is that we're natural allies with the restoration program, and we should not be adversaries, and the program should make a greater effort to really listen to our concerns and respond to them. You know, for a program that gets $14 to $15 million a year to not respond to a written request that was sent very respectfully, it's just inexcusable. You know, it doesn't take that much to sit down at a computer and write a response letter, even if it's thanks but no thanks. But in this case, the fishing guides got nothing, and so they really felt they had no other choice but to come on very strong. And we will continue to come on very strong until we see some reforms in the Trinity program, which I look forward to talking to you about in January.
I was just going to say we're out of time for today, but we'll check back with you in January and get a longer report on the Trinity and situation in the Delta.
Great. Thank you so much,
Thanks
Scott.
For your time, Tom.
Bye-bye.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name's Scott Greeson. I'm the North Coast Director of Friends of the Eel River, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guests today were Dennis Halligan, Senior Fisheries Biologist with Stillwater Sciences, and Tom Stokely with the California Water Impact Network. You can find more information about Stillwater at stillwatersci.com. You can find the California Water Impact Network at c-win.org. And for more information about the Trinity River Restoration Program I was discussing with Tom Stokely, look at trrp.net on the web. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Thereafter, the files from recent shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. You can find Friends of the Eel River, the group I work for, at eelriver.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. And many thanks to Fred McLaughlin, the indispensable engineer of this program. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.